Right. Northwoods League Baseball, the Kingfish take on the Wisconsin Rapids Rafters 7:05 tonight at Simmons Field. Now the forecast from the National Weather Service just ahead of the morning show. Mostly sunny and hot. Today's high 89. Now 72 degrees. We're seeing in Kenosha. Humidity high at 87%. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be talking today about the end of life, and specifically the special choices that are given to someone when they choose hospice care for the final days of their life. Of course, sometimes life ends for us in a very abrupt way, and such a choice is not possible, or maybe in other ways is not particularly appropriate. But certainly for many people, the end of life comes most peacefully when it is experienced within the careful, tender care of hospice care. And we're going to be talking about that today with two different guests. First of all, Rita Hagen, who has been with us before. She is executive director of Hospice Alliance of Kenosha. And with us, a very special guest, Kimberly Paul, who is in town. Good to have you here. Kimberly Paul, who is a nationally known authority, shall we say, in terms of hospice care. And she is actually at the midpoint of a tour across the country talking about the experiences that she's had for nearly 2 decades working in the field of hospice care. And this is her Live Well, Die Well tour, and she is going to be speaking later today, 5:30, at the Kenosha Women's Club, talking about many of the lessons that she has learned in working with people. She has a podcast called Death by Design and a highly regarded book on the topic called Bridging the Gap, Life Lessons from the Dying. Kimberly Paul and Rita Hagen, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Hey.
Morning, thank you.
By the way, Kimberly Paul is here with a special companion, since our listeners can't see her. Explain to our listeners who is with you today besides Rita Hagen.
Well, you know, with all great adventures, you have to have a sidekick. And the crazy thing is my German Shepherd thinks I'm the sidekick. So, yeah, Haven is a 7-year-old German Shepherd that has been forced to take on this adventure with me and be my protector as well as my companion. And I always say we, and that's just me and the dog. So I just, for some reason, I talk in the plural sense. So yeah, that's Haven. And she's named after a North Carolina town called Belhaven, where my grandmother grew up. So every time someone asks about her name, I get to remember my grandmother, who actually the book came out on her birthday.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
Very good. So you are traveling the country in an RV, you and Haven, and it's actually, in a sense, where you live, right?
Yeah. You know, it's my home for quite a while. Still, we're about halfway done. So till about 2021, we'll make our way through Canada, back through Michigan in the last leg of the journey, and we'll stop where we began in Lebanon, Ohio.
Very good. Well, we're anxious to hear your whole story. I want to turn first to Rita Hagen. And Rita, I would love to have you just remind our listeners of some of sort of the basic components of what Hospice Alliance does, and particularly Hospice Alliance of Kenosha, where you are the executive director.
Well, Hospice Alliance provides end-of-life care for those with a serious illness. We also provide palliative care for those not yet at end-of-life, but who are facing a chronic illness. We do that by offering them equipment in their home, meetings with our chaplain, our social workers, and a nurse case manager that works with them and the family. And that's the beauty of hospice care. We're kind of one of those differences in healthcare because we come to the patient and we bring hospice care wherever they call home. And we do that to make that journey a little bit better, help people with whatever needs there are, meeting the goals for end of life.
Right. So hospice care is sometimes experienced or received in somebody's own familiar home, but it is also possible, in Kenosha at least, for someone to actually be housed.
We have our 8-bed hospice house. It's a residential facility, and even though people's goals might be to be at home at end of life, there are just certain things sometimes that make that not possible. But we give them the next best thing, and that we give them the hospice house where they can be in a home-like setting. And family sometimes can just be family, because being a caregiver is very difficult work. And it allows a daughter to be a daughter, and or, you know, a husband to be the husband, because you can be so consumed with caring for the one you love.
Right. Generally speaking, how is it that someone begins receiving hospice care? I mean, does, for instance, their primary physician need to say something or do something that, in a sense, sort of sets that kind of care in motion?
Really, the referral can come in from anyone. And we have to have an order at some point. That's under the Medicare regulations. But if you're caring for someone or you know of someone and you see a general decline in them, I always say the one question to ask is, would I be really surprised if this person wasn't here in a year? And that's really your first clue to say, I'm going to call hospice. And we come in. There's no fees. It's a consult. We'll talk to you. We'll see what we can do to help you. And then we'll call the doctor. We'll get the orders. We'll do whatever is needed to make it as easy as possible on the patient or the family. Sometimes patients call us themselves and say, sometimes it's family, and often it's physician referrals or facility referrals.
So when somebody is choosing this for themselves or for a loved one, in effect, are they saying, I am done with the struggle, I am ready to die? Or does the decision to accept hospice care not represent that kind of choice exactly?
I think the problem is people look at hospice and think that people are giving up or giving up. You know, there's always hope, but I believe hospice is hope. Hope for a good death, hope for time with my family and not running to a million appointments, hope to be where I want to be, surrounded by the people I want to be with, and not maybe in a hospital bed. But the beauty of it is that it's about what you want. And that's what hospice brings to people, is helping to open up those conversations. And I think that's what, when we went to the conference and heard Kimberly talk, and it was just to hear someone else who gets it and understands it and be able to talk to people about it's, you know, it's not taboo to talk about what you want at end of life. People spend more time picking out a car they want than sometimes looking for what's important to them, you know, at end of life.
Right. And it sounds, Kimberly Paul, like that's one of the main messages of this tour that you are on right now, is to try to get people who are very sort of locked up and inhibited about approaching this topic to find a way to speak about it more openly and freely.
Yeah, I mean, I think the more I think about my mortality, the more boldly I live. Because when you know something's going to end, what do? You kind of push the limits and you want to experience everything. You know, this morning I got up, my alarm went off at 3:30 a.m. and I'm just like, ugh. But then guess what I got to experience? A sunrise over Wisconsin, which was the most beautiful thing I've seen in a long time, where the fog is lifting. And could that be the last time I see a sunrise? Possibly. I mean, things happen every day. And just to add to what Rita says, you know, palliative care and hospice, their specialty is to relieve suffering. The number one reason people fear death is because they don't want to suffer. And it's about coming collectively together to reclaim death from the medical community. You know, we don't talk a lot about how the medical community prolongs suffering and death and with false hope. So what I'm trying to do is really empower the community with education to meet the medical providers halfway and get the medical providers to be like, hey, when it comes to end of life, can we stop all this med speak and let's just talk human? Because there are some things that we're not going to solve, and I believe death is one of them. So that's where I want to – how can we meet in the middle?
It reminds me, Rita, I don't remember if we've talked about this before, but my sense is, without getting too specific here or naming any names, that there are different cultures when it comes to medical doctors, mm-hmm. and that there are some who have a real – reluctance to make this choice and often wait until the very, very end, maybe just a couple of weeks before somebody dies. And then there are other medical doctors where it's something that they are much more comfortable with, and that certain cultures can kind of spring up in different communities. For instance, a lot of the doctors in Kenosha versus a lot of the doctors in Racine, mm-hmm. and the way that they approach this. Is that kind of your experience as well? And is
yes.
that part of the work you have to do?
Yes. And I think, you know, as for Hospice Alliance, it's a part of our mission is to be involved and educate the community. And we've tried to do that in different ways. Obviously, having Kimberly here is amazing. We've shown Being Mortal. We've shown Consider the Conversation, offered it in Racine and Kenosha communities, because it's a way to educate people, to let them know you have a voice to talk to your physician about difficult conversations. And, you know, what I'll say about the medical community is, for a very long time, you know, they take an oath to save people, and it becomes very difficult for them. Gratefully, now, schools of medicine are approaching end of life and palliative care, and physicians are coming out with a little more, I guess, comfortableness. That's a word I'll make up.
I love it.
Being more comfortable
it
talking about.
It should be about, a word if it's
yes,
not.
That's right.
But talking about end of life and knowing that it's okay to say, there is not anything more I can do for you. So what is it you want right now? That's really what it is. You know, and you've got a world of medicine that's under productivity, 15-minute appointments. You know, it's almost like you got to have your note card ready to go. And that's not any one particular person's fault. That's just the way medicine is today. So, you know, people have to be their own advocates about your health, or when sometimes your health is failing, then about how I want to spend my journey, whether that's a year, 2 years, 2 months. And so that's important to us as Hospice Alliance, to that we are out there in the community letting people know you have choices, you have options, and speak up for yourself.
Right. One thing we should probably mention is the fact that we are not talking about practices which take this a step further, in which we're talking about an intervention that ends life earlier than it otherwise would. In other words, physician-assisted suicide or that kind of thing. I mean, as people are maybe casually listening to this conversation, I think it would be possible for somebody to make the mistake of, in a sense, confusing the two, of blending them together. Can you just speak to that distinction?
Well, I think they're two very, very separate things. And unfortunately, you're correct. People see hospice as one and the same with that. But hospice does not prolong life, but nor does it hasten death. And you allow the natural course that's going to take place happen. We just are there to help make sure it's comfortable. It's meeting all the goals that you want. You want to be there with people. You want music playing. You want not to have people around. Whatever those goals are, that's what we're there to do and make sure that you do not suffer. But they are two very, very separate, and we try very hard. We're often asked our thoughts on that, but they are very different, and hospice does not and would not be involved in that.
Right. A last question before we get to the amazing story of Kimberly Paul, our special guest in the room. Rita, speak to the whole matter of who pays for hospice care. And is that something that, generally speaking, is not a serious issue for someone who has insurance that would cover much of what we would think was kind of standard medical care? When someone makes this shift into hospice care, does their insurance, generally speaking, sort of flow right along with them into this different path?
Well, hospice began as a Medicare benefit, and you know, in a perfect world, I'd like to say it's only Medicare patients, but the truth of it is that there's very young people who die, and that's what happens. It is part of the Medicare benefit. Anything that is involved with whatever that terminal diagnosis that got you admitted into hospice, anything that you need to be cared for, whether it's medications or equipment, are paid for as long as they're covered under that terminal diagnosis. For people who are not Medicare age, more and more, thankfully, insurance companies are having some sort of hospice benefit. But that hasn't always been the case, but it is becoming that. And we have our hospice house, which has room and board. There is no insurance, no Medicare, no insurance anywhere that covers room and board. And I think we're even finding that some people who've paid for a very long time for long-term care insurance all of a sudden find out it doesn't pay for room and board either, which is very unfortunate. At our hospice house, or for us, again, part of our mission is we've never turned anyone away for inability to pay, and we're very proud of that. We're the hospice, the other hospice is called, when someone doesn't have insurance and needs a place to live in our hospice house or really to be cared for anywhere.
Wow. Can I also speak to what has come up from time to time and actually come up very recently, I hasten to add, not at all with Kenosha Hospice Care, but intermittent controversy sometimes about what level of care is being given and the monies received and so on, that apparently there have been certain entities within the hospice industry, shall we say, that have been maybe less than transparent or less than completely truthful. I guess we're talking about plain old fraud, sad to say, in certain places in the industry. Can you just speak to how the Kenosha Hospice Alliance conducts its affairs and your attention to those kind of concerns? I mean, the kind of reputation that you are very determined to maintain.
Again, and something else I'm extremely proud of, we've been around for a very long time, almost 40 years, providing hospice care. We were one of the first to provide hospice care when the hospice movement first was coming into the United States. So if you figure we started in 1981, and I think it was about 1976 that Dame Cicely Saunders came over and talked about having hospice here. So we've done this for a really long time, but we're small. And so we do things right because that's the right thing to do, but also it wouldn't be good for us if something ever did happen. We couldn't afford. We don't have that kind of backing of a huge hospital system behind us or a nationwide hospice program that's in every state. We don't have that kind of money. So we're proud of the fact that we follow the rules. And the hardest thing we ever have to do is say no to somebody, to say, right now you don't meet criteria for hospice, but we're going to check in every couple of weeks. Or if you notice a decline or you notice this, especially in Alzheimer's patients, it's so very difficult. Families need so much help, and they're very hard to get admitted to hospice because it takes almost to the point where they can't eat or walk or talk before they're eligible.
Wow.
And the reason for that is it lasts a long time, and they would be on the Medicare benefit for a long time. So that is very important to us. We try to follow the thing that we're promise makers and we're promise keepers. We don't want to be promise breakers. And so we'll have lots of times people call and say, well, so-and-so will do this, this, and that. And we say, we can't do that, but this is what we can do for you. Hmm. We will give you a CNA when you need it. We will help you. We are available 24/7, 365. We actually have a nurse around the clock that will come out to your home if you need it or go to a facility if needed. We're not just a phone call and then we talk you through it. So those are the things we're very proud of that we do. And sadly, it's a business and you're competing against a lot of those that are not. And I think that's the other great thing about what Kimberly's doing is she's bringing attention because, again, in some of the New York Times articles, it's never the great stories about hospice. It's never the wonderful things that are being done. It's always about those ones that are breaking the rules or not providing care. Right. Like they're going to say, we're going to be at your bedside 24/7 when the patient's dying. Well, they say that because when people are dying, there's a different rate that you can get from Medicare. But are you really there? We say we're going to do our best to get you there. And if we can't, we're going to try to get a volunteer. But we'll do our best to cover you. But it's not, you can't say you're going to be there continuously. So that's why I say we are promise keepers. We want to offer you what we can provide to you, and we will give you the best possible care.
By the way, where do the rules and regulations for the hospice industry come from? I mean, under whose auspices is hospice care provided?
It's under the federal government as CMS created it, but then each state also has its own. So if the federal government says that you know, need to say it's a year, end of life for a year, but if your state says the doctor has to certify that 6 months or less, then you have to follow your state's rules. So you're always comparing the two.
Right. And even when we're talking about something as important and deeply personal as hospice care and end of life, it's important that there are rules.
Yes.
And of course, and it's important that they are followed. And right. It sounds like Kenosha Hospice Alliance takes that very seriously.
Right. And I think what people need to know is even if you get on hospice, that doesn't mean you're always on hospice. People have come off of hospice. Studies have shown that people improve when you relieve a lot of the stressors that exist with caregiving and end of life. So, again, it's difficult because you have this relationship with this patient, this family, you've helped them. But if they're not meeting criteria because you have to recertify them, then we have to talk to them about that. But then again, we're there if you need us again down the line. And we're happy that you have gotten strong enough that really hospice isn't what you need right now.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Rita Hagen, Executive Director of Hospice Alliance of Kenosha, and with a very special guest in our studio, Kimberly Paul. She is a nationally recognized voice when it comes to hospice care, author of a book called Bridging the Gap, Life Lessons from the Dying. She has a podcast called Death by Design, and she is at about the halfway point of her Live Well, Die Well tour. She is crisscrossing the country in her RV with her beautiful German Shepherd Haven at her side. And she's going to be speaking today at 5:30 at the Kenosha Women's Club, talking about hospice care and all that she has learned in the many years that she has worked with hospice patients. So Kimberly Paul, one of the most intriguing things about your story is that you used to do something very, very different that has, at least on the surface, absolutely nothing to do with providing hospice care to people. Tell our listeners briefly about your background in the world of entertainment.
Yeah, you know, when I was not 12 years old, you know, dreaming about working in hospice care. I know that's hard to believe, but I was a creative kid. I wanted to write for television. And after I graduated from college and spent a summer in Raleigh, North Carolina, I took a big leap and packed my Honda Accord and went to New York City. And within 30 days, landed a job on Saturday Night Live. A lot of people are like, oh, did you write for Saturday? I'm like, no, I was a peon. That's where you start in the entertainment business. And
Getting coffee and sleeping floors?
Honey, coffee, meatball sandwiches. There's some people, even today, I want to push that meatball sandwich in their face. And then there's others who I found, you know, very pleasant, like Eric Clapton. You know, who've experienced death from a small child and unexpectedly, and so there's always good and there's always bad. You know, there's nothing really anything that's like 100%. You know, positive. I think that's life, you know, and I think this is what the tour's teaching me is that whatever you're doing, your good and bad's going to find you. It's the tour's teaching me how to react to it, because even the bad can be a clue of what to or to not to do. But yeah, I was working in entertainment. Never really thought that I would be in this field. I entered it reluctantly. But I thought I would go back to television, but it ended up being 17 years, so pretty amazing.
Wow. So exactly what was the path that led you into being a part of hospice care?
Oh, gosh. It's sort of a funny story. I was just wanting to volunteer with hospice, and I have to even admit that I was so green to the healthcare world that I even called it hospice. My grandmother passed away with breast cancer, and so I was hoping to get a gig on Dawson's Creek in Wilmington, North Carolina, that was shooting, and I had some time before they were starting to shoot, and so I wanted to volunteer, and I ended up in an actual job interview. They offered me the job on the spot, and I was like, well, why not? And I really thought I was going to be there for, you know, 6 months or less, and it ended up being 17 years. And I think good journalist, which I hope and I feel like I'm truly am a journalist, is you follow the good stories. And people ask me all day long about Saturday Night Live and CBS Daytime and my film career and stuff like that. But I will say this, the most rewarding experience I've ever had was working within a hospice that is very similar to Hospice Alliance right here in your own community. And I only work with hospices with this mindset. It's mission over money. It's what drives us. It's not what you do, it's why you do it. And that's where people will be interested in hearing your story, is why. And these individuals that are working and that I partner with, they have a mission-driven attitude. They don't only take care of patients and families. They try very hard to surround their staff with as much support as possible. And, you know, I know what Rita and Hospice Alliance is dealing with, because I think it's totally overregulated. And that's one of the things that I'm trying to talk to Washington, D.C. about, is like, yes, you know, with everything, people are going to do bad things. But there are so many good hospices out there that are being penalized. And who suffers the most because of the tight regulations? It's the patient's family and the staff. So I really want to eventually take my tour to Washington, D.C. and say, hey, you know, how can we expand this benefit to include staff education and staff support, but also stop with the harshness? You know, the one thing that I say is that some things at end of life cannot be regulated. You know, we have different fingerprints, all three of us in this room, and we're going to face our deaths all differently. And this benefit needs to stretch like a rubber band so that we can trust the professionals to take care of the dying exactly where they want to be. And sometimes I just get fed up with people in Washington who get free health care telling us how to practice hospice care. And I feel like that's what I want to do, is do a little bit of a Jon Stewart on them. Because, you know what? I'm fighting for my own end of life here. I want hospice. And I don't want to be told no. Whether I want, you know, my vodka tonic or, you know, a cigarette, I want people to meet me. And the creator of the modern hospice movement, Dame Cicely Saunders, she created this movement so that the service would conform to the patient and family. And now what we're doing in America is we're really forcing these hospice organizations to ask families and patients to conform to a benefit.
So it's the tendency in America is towards kind of a one-size-fits-all.
Yeah. I mean, we've monetized death. I mean, that's not what we should be doing. And that's where I'm very passionate about this. You know, I want people in this that has the heart, the mind, and the soul. And how do we support those taking care of the dying? And that's really important to me because I've seen a lot of really five-star employees walk out because of compassion fatigue. It is not a relaxed environment. We carry a lot of weight and a lot of compassion fatigue because of grief that we get close to these patients and families. And I really feel that I want those special people to be at my bedside, and I want to demand that. And so really, I'm very selfish in what I'm talking about right now because I'm talking about my own family's experience one day with hospice and my own. And I want the best of the best. And so I feel like I have to fight for that long before there's a healthcare crisis in my own life.
Talk for a moment about what it feels like to do this kind of work. You've already kind of touched on that and the fact that it is a heavy emotional weight that one tends to bear when you are working in the field of hospice care. You get close to these patients and so on. And I think somebody, again, rather casually listening from the sidelines might assume that this is work that is really sad and really bleak and really depressing. And yet I have talked to so many people who have given hospice care or been part of the hospice field where the story is exactly the opposite.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's, you know, we wouldn't be in this field. I feel like we do give a lot. But man, I don't think it ever compares to what we receive as human beings, connection with people that were once strangers that become family. And of course, when you love people and you care for them, you're going to grieve them. And this is a lesson that the dying has taught me is that, you know, time is not measured in length. It's measured in depth. And what these hospice employees are doing is depth work. You know, a lot of people, when you hear someone is dying, they turn away because we Americans are really, really bad at watching someone suffer in grief and suffer into or die because we can't solve it. And so here are these wonderful human beings. First of all, the CNAs, and I think you guys call them the CNAs, who are really, truly keeping Dame Cicely Saunders' vision completely alive with connection. But then they have this entire team that is really run by a case manager, normally an RN, and then oversaw by a physician. But there's a chaplain, there's a social worker that really looks at this family as a unit and how do we surround this family and meet as many needs as we can. And this is what's crazy, is that hospice benefit that we keep talking about that reimburses us, it really does not have anything to do with taking care of individuals at end of life. And let me tell you why. It's because most people, when we get to their bedside, they're more interested in learning how can I see my first grandchild being born, or can I go fishing again? Can I do this? Can I? And these hospice individuals not only surround them and manage some very difficult pain management and symptoms when it comes to end of life to make sure that quality is extremely high, no matter at what point we're in our journey at end of life, but that these special things are magically happening because the hospice staff, what do? They listen. They show up. They don't look away. And sometimes they say it sucks. Man, it does suck to lose someone we love and to watch someone die. But get this. This is the cycle of life. Ever since I was born, I have been dying, and I am not going to go quietly into the rage of the dying of the light. You know, I want to live boldly today. And get this, dying patients in hospice care taught me how to live. And that's where the book comes in with the 15 lessons I've learned is really how to live. And death is a moment, people. Just one moment, even the dying or living. And so hospice comes in and surrounds them to make sure that they are getting everything and meeting that patient family so that living can happen. And, you know, I'm really, I feel like we can ignore this whole possibility that one day we're not going to die. And you can go through and walk down that road. But man, I think you're missing out on a grand opportunity to say one day this will end. And this is what makes this day so much more precious than it once was. And I feel like the dying has taught me how to live and die on my own terms.
When someone is receiving hospice care, are there a lot of decisions and choices that the person dying and or their closest circle of caregivers and loved ones have to make? Or is hospice care by and large a simpler thing? I mean, are there a lot of choices along
well,
the way?
Well, I mean, my opinion is, you know, we should be thinking, all three of us, about what we need to do to prepare for our end of life today. We're healthy. We're not emotional. What would we want? And there is, of course, in America, there's legal paperwork. But, you know, there's a trifecta. You know, the legal paperwork with called advanced directives means nothing without the conversation, as well as incorporating your care officials. And, you know, that's part of what I'm going to really try to address tonight is empowering people. If you're interested in dying well, why are you not volunteering with a hospice organization and learning more about what they do at the end of life? Why are we waiting until we're in a healthcare crisis to make decisions? Because, you know, I, when I'm emotional, I don't make really good decisions. And so my family and I have talked about this because my chances of dying has increased now that I'm driving a 29-foot RV and towing a car. And I'm fully aware of that. But I do think there's some things worth risking everything for, and that is to empower the individual to reclaim their life as well as their death, whether it's from the medical community or from, you know, a tired old job or something. Why are we not running with our hair on fire? Because this is going to end one day. And it's such a beautiful life when you're living. And that means stopping and smelling the roses and stopping and paying attention to things that matter most. And what is crazy is at the end of life, what matters most will surprise you. It's not titles. It's not job. It's not money. It's testimonies. Mm-hmm. It's relationships. It's connection. And in a world that's forcing us to be disconnected, because we communicate through Facebook or email or social media, and which is the hugest fake news ever. But you know, there's always something in between us. We don't even know how to have real conversations anymore, how to connect. When I was in high school, my mom every Friday would bake a bundt cake, and put it on the, you know, cooling rack and go to all of us kids and my father and say, touch the cake and you die. Because the reason she was baking it, because she was hoping neighbors would stop by, ring the doorbell on a Saturday, and she would have something to offer them with a cup of coffee to have conversation. Now, what do we do when the doorbell rings? We hide. We're like, they didn't text us. What's going on? What has changed? Because my grandmother grew up very, very poor, but she says she was the richest person ever because she had close relationships with her neighbors, her community, and especially her family. And some of the lessons that I learned are not easy. Forgiving someone is not easy. But when you read the story in my book about forgiveness, I challenge you, you know, if you can't forgive someone after reading that story, I will be completely surprised, because that was the ultimate forgiveness for me.
I think what's interesting here is that I think what you're talking about is that when people approach the end of life, if they are in the situation where, I mean, a grand piano didn't just fall on them and kill them, but I mean, they see death coming and are preparing for it, that we see life differently and understand what matters most differently at that point in life. And that's why you're learning these lessons. It's not that these are all people who are just smarter than the rest of us, but they are at a place in life when they see life very differently than the rest of us who get caught up in a lot of stuff that might
not
matter
as much.
Well, they
could be our greatest teachers, because we don't have to be dying today or tomorrow or imminently dying to wake up to the lessons that they are trying to teach us.
Absolutely.
And I wonder, to what extent are some of the lessons you're learning also from the loved ones that you meet in the course of doing hospice work, not just the person themselves dying, but those who are closest to them?
Yeah, I think that's what's special about hospice, is that hospice admits the entire family and cares for the entire unit. There is no separation between patient and family. We admit them all to our services and surround them with just as many support systems as we do the patient. And that's what I'm trying to get across, is that people are waiting way too long to receive hospice care and are scared because of the word hospice means end of life. Whether you get hospice or not, you will die one day. And let me tell you, I want my death to be with people who are going to shepherd me in and help my family come. And I do think and I do believe that the way we die is the way people will grieve us. And I want to slide into my home plate, look over my shoulder and be like, "Whoa, that was a ride." And look for the next great adventure. And I think when you live fully, you can say that. You're prepared to die at any moment, especially if it's a piano on your head, because there's nothing left unsaid. Hmm. And so, yeah, every time I talk to my father on the phone, I'm like, "Dad, I love you," because that might be the last time I ever talk to him or him to me. Hmm. And it's so, yes, the dying has put on, these glasses that have taught me certain things, but these are lessons for all of us. And we get caught up in this treadmill of life that we sometimes forget what's really most important. Hmm.
I should think that one of the challenges of those that work in hospice care is that you end up working with such a wide array of people with all kinds of different backgrounds and so on. And in particular, that some people come to the end of life with a religious faith that is extremely important to them and that really guides the way that they see this experience. And then, of course, you have other people where that is not part of who they are at all, and they are looking at this very, very differently. What kind of a challenge is it for you as someone, and Rita, feel free to jump in if you like, in terms of who this patient is and what is important to them when it comes to those kind of matters? I assume that hospice is there to allow them to be whoever they are and whatever they happen to believe. But I should.
Well,
think
I mean, I think it's religion is different than spirituality to me. Mm-hmm. So, I feel like I'm a spiritual being. And, whether I follow Taoism, Buddhist, Christianity, or, other things, that's just a part of it. But I do feel like I'm a spiritual being, and what I believe is sort of a different aspect. Rita can answer this, but I can tell you what she's going to say is because they're going to meet people right where they're at. If they are not interested in the religion aspect, but maybe in a spiritual aspect or nothing at all, we're not there to project the death we think onto them. Mm. We're there to show up and say, what is the most important thing from this moment moving forward, and do it. And that's what truly hospice is. So, I talk about it. I can't wait. Because, I don't smoke anymore. I can't wait until a serious illness, because I'm going to light up a cigarette and I'm going to have a whiskey and I'm going to do things that I stopped because I wanted to live more healthy. And I look forward to that day where I can smoke a cigarette. But yeah, it's like.
But that's not everybody.
The
point is that.
You meet the person where they're at.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
And I think. For staff, it is, separating your own personal beliefs to meet the beliefs of what they are. And if somebody is not a part of a faith but all of a sudden feels before they die they want to be, then we're going to do whatever we can to help make that connection for them. But in turn, if they have no faith at all, then we're going to guide them however that is best. And that's what we do. It's about them creating their plan for end of life and what makes that good for them. And then helping that family. You know, you have 5 siblings. They might not all be on the same page, so we help to try to make sure.
Might not?
Yeah. Understand why that person's wishes, why they're important to them, you know, whether it's facilitating those conversations, taking them on the side. And just to go back to what Kimberly had said about advanced directives, and I think that's really what's so very important, and we in this community are trying to do a lot more education on that because the paperwork needs to be filled out. That's the law. We can't get around that. But if you don't talk about it and why you want those things done, you're going to leave a lot of unanswered questions. And then if you did that way early on, you know, from the time somebody's like 18, they should be talking to their parents mm-hmm. about what's important to them because bad stuff does happen even if you're 18 mm-hmm. years old.
Of course.
And, you know, let's go way back to, you know, Karen Ann Quinlan.
Absolutely.
That look what happened there because she never formalized. And then you had a husband saying one thing and a family. And then, you know, your heart's involved. And that isn't always the best thinker for you. So
I think the biggest tragedy is that people have this misconception about hospice. What's really a tragedy to me is to see people fully alive, not with a serious illness, allowing something inside them die every day. And so how do we step back and reclaim really the purpose of why we were all created? And that's to connect with one another, to spread goodness and you know, not project. And, you know, where do we go wrong? Where if you don't think like I think, you're wrong. I think if you don't think like I think, then tell me more. You might just change my mind. And that's where I'm coming from, is to awaken people's souls long before they have a serious illness, to live more boldly, but also make some of these decisions now. So you can have the last word, because that's definitely what I want. You know, I want to write letters, and they are in my lockbox right now. If something would happen to me on the road, that would go to my best friend from high school that I've known for 37 years to tell her how much she has meant to me. And I just feel like those are the creative aspects that really bring color into this whole taboo black and white subject of life and death. Let's make it colorful.
Well, hopefully people are talking about this a bit more than they were 20 years ago. And certainly you are doing something really important in sort of awakening us to the importance of this. And I know a lot of people are looking forward to what you have to share today at 5:30 at the Kenosha Women's Club. And I have a feeling that this vibrant conversation has probably encouraged a few others to be there as well. Rita, remind our listeners of exactly where the Women's Club is and what they need to do, or if it is as simple as just showing
up. Just showing up. We're not taking RSVPs. We've got seats for about 200 people, and we would love to have people standing in the room. The Women's Club is at 6028 8th Avenue, right across from Simmons Library down there.
Very good. And remind people, if they want to get in touch with Hospice Alliance of Kenosha, what is the best way to do that?
Just give us a call, 262-652-4400, and we will hook you up right away to talk with someone in our intake department. Mary's our expert, and she'll help guide you with who what those decisions are. And we come out just to talk with you and your family. There's no fees or charges involved with that, just to guide you.
Very good. And Kimberly Paul, what is the address of your wonderful website, which I visited earlier?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, it's deathbydesign.com. But if you really want to follow the tour, it's livewelldiewelltour.com. So join me. And if you have someone that you'd like to add to the top of my RV that you've lost, you can go to my website and email me, and I will send you a picture of carrying your loved one with me on this whole journey of finding connection within loss.
Fantastic. Kimberly Paul, the author of Bridging the Gap, Life Lessons from the Dying, and a special guest of the Kenosha Hospice Alliance, speaking today, 5:30 at the Kenosha Women's Club. Great to meet you.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you.
And Rita Hagen, the executive director at Kenosha Hospice Alliance. Thank you for all of the good work that you and your staff do, and thank you for being a part of the morning show. It's always great to talk with you.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we're going to be talking with several different people, including Nan Calvert in her monthly visit to the program, about a project out at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside to try and save a certain species of honeybee. And it's going to be a great conversation. I hope that you will make a special point of listening. We want to remind you that the morning show is archived on our website, WGTD.org, and you can also subscribe to the morning show as a podcast via Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast. Just look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg, and you can find a whole host of morning shows there to enjoy. And the morning